For the 17th year, the National Newspaper Publishers Association is observing National Negro Newspaper Week in commemoration of the founding of the first Negro newspaper in the United States in 1827, 128 years ago. Today, the National Broadcasting Company presents transcribed spokesmen from the National Newspaper Publishers Association. We will also hear a panel of experts in the field of race relations discuss the subject, desegregation today. Concluding this special broadcast will be the announcement of the winners of the 1955 Russworm Awards, given annually by the National Newspaper Publishers Association to 10 persons or organizations who have made signal contributions to American life. To tell you more about Negro Newspaper Week, here is C.C. Desjoie, Jr., managing editor of the Louisiana Weekly of New Orleans and president of the National Newspaper Publishers Association.
Thank you, Mr. Brandt. It is entirely fitting that this event should be observed here in New York, for it was not many blocks away at 5 Varick Street in New York that John B. Russworm got out the first issue of Freedom's Journal, the first Negro newspaper published in the United States. In his first editorial, he stated, "The civil rights of a people being of the greatest value, it shall ever be our duty to vindicate our brethren when oppressed and to lay the case before the public." Russworm went on to say, "In the spirit of candor and humility, we intend by simple presentation of facts to lay our case before the public with a view to arresting the progress of prejudice and to shield ourselves against the consequent evils. We wish to conciliate all and to irritate none, yet we must be firm and unwavering in our principles and persevering in our efforts." In those words, Russworm set out a concept that has served as a guiding principle for nearly every one of thousands of newspapers published by Negroes that were to follow. Today, the Negro press subscribes to a credo which in large measure repeats these same ideals. It reads, "The Negro press believes that America can best lead the world away from racial and national antagonisms when it accords to every man, regardless of race, color, or creed, his human and legal rights. Hating no man, fearing no man, the Negro press strives to help every man in the firm belief that all are hurt as long as anyone is held back." And though John Russworm and his partner Samuel Cornish, back in 1827, could not know the exact shape of things to come, they did realize that civilization to endure must build upon these firm precepts of justice, equality, that are the keystones of our way of life. The President of the United States, Dwight D. Eisenhower, says, "My greetings to the members of the National Newspaper Publishers Association and to all observing National Negro Newspaper Week. The commemoration of the founding of the first Negro newspaper 128 years ago is a clear reminder of our people's historic belief in freedom to speak and write according to conviction. We of the Negro press intend to write and speak from the conviction that true equality among men and a devotion to fundamental justice must be inseparably a part of the great American tradition."
Thank you, Mr. Desjoie. Now here is Ben Grauer, commentator and news analyst for NBC, who will serve as moderator for our panel discussion.
Thank you, Mr. Brandt. We are pleased to have with us four recognized experts in their particular fields to discuss the subject of desegregation in our world today. They are Lester B. Granger, executive director of the National Urban League, former president of the National Conference of Social Work; Roy Wilkins, administrator for the National Association for the Advancement of Colored People and nationally known lecturer; James C. Evans, civilian aide to the Secretary of Defense; and Dowdell H. Davis, past president of the National Newspaper Publishers Association and general manager of the Kansas City Call. Now, Mr. Granger, I'm going to start with you. The Urban League has long been recognized as a foremost agent in the elimination of discrimination in industry, housing, and related fields. Could you tell us of the progress of desegregation in those areas?
Yes, Mr. Grauer. We in the Urban League feel that we've made notable progress in the last 10 years, especially in removing segregation in industrial employment. There are as yet only 12 states that have fair employment laws, and there is no present prospect of a federal law on the subject. But in the meantime, while we're waiting for tougher legislation and more widespread legislation, we have largely smashed the stereotype of Negro jobs, which provided Negro employment at unequal pay for the same work. We have begun the penetration into skilled and technical and white-collar jobs at an amazing degree. And the union coverage of collective bargaining agreements has brought one and a quarter million Negro workers into union membership and under the protection of their seniority and the promotional rights. And thus, this coverage lessens their chances of being the first fired and the last hired in case of recession. In the housing field, we are just about where we were in employment 20 years ago. We are at the business now of attacking the fallacy that non-whites, upon moving into a neighborhood, automatically impair the status of the neighborhood and destroy property. I would say that the prospects are fair and warmer for tomorrow.
Fine, Mr. Granger. We'll get back to you later, I hope. Mr. Wilkins, it's true, is it not, that the National Association for the Advancement of Colored People has for years spearheaded the legal battles that have resulted in greatly broadening our interpretation of democracy and which culminated in the Supreme Court decision on schools, probably the most far-reaching of all of them. You agree with that?
Well, Mr. Grauer, I think that's true. The National Association for the Advancement of Colored People, since its beginning in 1909, has been a sort of legal spearhead on these matters. And this has been an objective, that is, the elimination of segregation of the Negro press since the first paper was issued in 1827. This demand for elimination of discrimination, which we regard as being inherent in segregation, has motivated the NAACP in its successful legal actions, which have outlawed housing covenants, for example, the white primary, which prevented many, many hundreds of thousands of Negroes from voting in the South, certain injustices in court procedure, such as due process of law, and the exclusion of Negro students from tax-supported colleges in the South. As Mr. Granger has said, considerable progress has been registered in nearly all fields of endeavor. But there remains in employment, as he has indicated, widespread denial of jobs on the basis of race and color. There has been some progress in public housing, not very much in private housing. And of course, the Supreme Court opinion of last May 17th means that the segregated pattern in public education is now outlawed. The next step, which we're all awaiting, is the argument on the decrees and the actual handing down of decrees by the Supreme Court.
Mm-hmm. Thank you. Thanks, Mr. Wilkins, for updating us on this problem. As civilian aide to the Secretary of Defense, Mr. Evans, could you tell us something about desegregation, as the term might be applied to our armed forces, or for that matter, to our government services in general?
To begin with, we rejected the term desegregation in planning our program of complete racial integration in the armed forces. Likewise, in this discussion today, we take the liberty of addressing ourselves to the revised topic, integration in our world today. Applied science and applied social science will tell us that anything less is incomplete and unstable. Integration in the armed forces, Army, Navy, Air Force, and Marine Corps, has moved to completion ahead of schedule and with no untoward incidents whatsoever. Recently, I received from a military post in Heidelberg the following observation written by a Negro officer and gentleman, editor and scholar, quote, "The armed forces in racial matters may well take credit for having shown the way and for having gone more nearly all the way than any other organization, institution, grouping, or agency of national scope and import," end of quotation.
Thank you. Thank you indeed, Mr. Evans. We're going to talk with you a little later on and some of the thoughts that come out of what you've told us. Now, let's see. Mr. Davis, as spokesman for the Negro press, how would you say this discussion, how does this sum up from the broader point of view of the public at large and from the Negro press point of view in particular?
Well, Mr. Grauer, I suppose it would be entirely proper that the point of view of the Negro press should be presented in the cleanup position in this discussion. It quite often falls our lot to compile, to analyze, and to organize the various influences affecting Negro life, with the hope that a complete pattern can be evolved, which will make each of them a good deal more meaningful. Now, ours is a role of many facets, as you could well understand. Traditionally, I think the Negro press has been a crusading press. Our cause for being lies in the fact that we live in an imperfect society, in a democracy which is still grappling with the problem of how best to square its practices with its announced purposes. Personally, I like to think of the Negro press as the voice of the conscience of our nation. It is a constant reminder of the job for democracy yet to be done. It is a source of inspiration, sometimes the only source for about 15 million Americans that we know as Negroes. It is a means by which the total picture of our society is rounded out and supplying the news, the opinions, and the ideas often ignored by other mass media.
No, Mr. Davis, we have some time while we're all gathered together. I thought we might talk, the four of us, to each other and across the table, if you like. So I'm going to ask you first to start our round table. I'm going to ask you to answer this question, Mr. Davis. In your remarks, you say the topic of today might well be one used in any other given day during the life of the Negro press. Just what do you mean by that?
Well, simply that the attitudes that will produce segregation and set up discriminations on a flimsy basis of color have been the constant targets of Negro journalism since its very beginnings. They're exemplified in many ways. Of course, this thing that we've been battering against, sometimes it has appeared in the course of history in the form of human bondage. Maybe it's exemplified by such things as the Ku Klux Klan or by the blot of lynching that used to be very current. And now maybe the thing is a little bit more subtle. It takes the form of discrimination in places of public accommodation and job discriminations. But essentially, it's the kind of thing which permits this sort of thinking and these sort of habits that the Negro press has constantly been battling against. And that, I don't believe, has altered too much during the course of history.
Mm-hmm. I was trying to think of one word as you spoke of the many aspects of this thing which civilization has been battering against, as you say, through the centuries. Prejudice is one simple word. Fear is another. Would you agree with both those words?
I would say that both of them certainly apply to the situation, yes.
Mr. Granger, how does what we are talking about apply to the fact that we have improved situation in industry and fair employment practices, as you say, improved, but nowhere near that improvement of the housing field?
Well, it's because housing is just about where industry was, as I said before, just about where industry was 20 years ago. 20 years ago, the concept was that the Negro was, by the very fact of his race, an inferior worker. We had to destroy that concept. Today, the concept is that the Negro is, by very fact of his being a Negro, an undesirable neighbor. And that has to be destroyed. You've got to go right down to the cellar. And it's that feeling that has made it difficult, for instance, for Negroes to get full participation in housing projects, which should be open to all the people, to get funds from banks and mortgage companies to buy or build. And until we've disposed of that, we're not going to get very far with solving the housing problems of the non-whites.
I sense you edging close to this microphone, Mr. Wilkins. Go ahead.
I was thinking, as Mr. Granger was talking, that one of the tools that we can use, aside from the legal attack, which I spoke of earlier, would be the political approach. And there's some evidence that the Negro voter in certain strategic areas is using his political power for the general good, which also includes his good. I don't believe, Mr. Grauer, not to get into a very hot subject, I don't believe that the Negro vote as such is a block vote or a definable vote, because we have Negro real estate men who believe in abolishing rent control. We have Negro insurance men who are more interested in the U.S. tax system than they are in the Negro question as such. But it does mean that the Negro is using his vote increasingly to better his position.
There's one problem that every majority or minority has had, and that's the problem of individuals who insist on feathering their immediate nest.
Exactly so, and you also have class and economic interests regardless of race.
Yes, but speaking of hot subjects, I know we gentlemen gathered around this table are devoted to that very need of getting into hot subjects when you fight the old demons of prejudice and fear. You agree?
I think our record shows that we've suffered a lot on that account.
All right, now, Mr. Evans, come on over to this microphone. You were talking of the progress in the armed forces. You spoke with the... I sensed a very real pride about the progress that's been made there. You say better than perhaps any other segment of our national life. Now, I'm going to ask you, what do you consider the point of highest significance in connection with success of the program of integration in the armed forces.
I think we and the Negro press and all of us here can speak with pride of this accomplishment because all the gentlemen of this panel have been consultants at the Pentagon any number of times.
Mm-hmm.
Mr. Davis and Mr. Granger and his staff, Mr. Wilkins and his staff. The armed forces were large and visible and vulnerable 10 years ago and the 20 years ago that Mr. Granger was speaking of a moment ago. But we have had the very great fortune of being able to develop what we call Exhibit A, because we can now show a very large-scale development, which is functioning successfully in all parts of the world under the American flag. So at our greatest pride, in addition to strengthening our fighting forces, and let me assure you there has been no diminution in the strength of the fighting forces with our integration program, but beyond that, our opportunity to set up a large-scale example of substituting coordination and cooperation for conflict and confusion in human affairs.
You feel, Mr. Evans, I'm not going to let you get away, because the idea of non-segregation in the armed forces is something that every one of us can grasp when we see combat pictures of Negro and white men fighting together, right?
Right.
That tells everyone, white and Negro, a story that can't be skipped. Why is it that these specifics are moving along faster in the armed forces than they are in the, well, perhaps I'm answering it by saying less disciplined segments of our national life?
Three things. The Negro press took off after us first. Second, there was a clear decision.
Well, what do you mean by that, took off? They mean they said, come, how about this, boys?
We were their number one target. I have in my briefcase here an entire roll of what the Negro press said to us and about us over the years,
mm-hmm.
And we were able to answer them first with a clear decision, which they helped us to develop, and then with clear authority all the way up and down the line.
Score one for journalism, be it printed or electronic. Okay, what's your next point?
Printed or electronic are both. The matter of communications, and I was just looking at this equipment here. I'm going upstairs after I get through this corps. My field is electrical engineering. And while working with Granger, I work even more closely with Julius Thomas on the matter of jobs. Walker and I across there, Editor Walker from Cleveland Call Post, took a jet flight not long ago and did in 30 minutes what it used to take us 30 hours to do. If we can do those things in applied science and through applied science, we in the armed forces are going to demand, back at the press now, that we do similar things in the matter of human relations.
Davis, you're up.
Well, I was just thinking, as Mr. Evans was talking, the fact that this jet flight that he referred to...
By the way, weren't you on that flight, Donald?
No, I was supposed to have been there, and I frankly believe it was discrimination, Mr. Evans. I did, however, want to point out one other thing, Mr. Grauer, and that was this, that all of these things that have been mentioned by the various panel discussants leads me to one conclusion, and that is, of course, as would be expected, confined somewhat to my own field, which is journalism.
Yes.
And that is the need not only to have these things delineated, but also the need to have them create a kind of a pattern that we can come to grips with, something which will present itself in a neat enough package so that it sort of points away and lets people understand where all of these programs are going and what they seek to accomplish. Too often, we don't get very much of it in the other mass media. For instance, in reading the daily press, I suspect one would be led to believe that Negroes essentially are not born. And they don't die. They don't get married. They have no particular church life. There is no social activity. There are many of the normal activities that simply are not at all dealt with. And it's the effort to give these things direction as well as to give the individual status. To make him feel that he belongs to a positive, definite society, to feel that he has an obligation to that society, and that society is willing to reward him in terms of his accomplishments as well as the extent to which he accepts that obligation, that I think the Negro press certainly is concerning itself with today. And as these things have been developed, it's an effort, again, to give this whole program status, to give it understanding and to give it interpretation. I believe, of course, that we have been able to function with some fair degree of effectiveness in that area.
I'm going to, in closing, ask one specific question of Mr. Wilkins. There have been predictions of violence if full desegregation is attempted in some areas. Do you think this will occur?
Frankly, Mr. Grauer, I don't believe it will occur. First of all, Most Americans, the vast majority, are law-abiding. And second, I don't believe any community wants to institute violence against children.
That's a potent answer. Thank you, Mr. Wilkins and Mr. Granger and Mr. Evans and Mr. Davis. You have just heard a panel discussion on the subject desegregation in our world today. Heard on our panel were Lester B. Granger of the National Urban League, Roy Wilkins of the NAACP, James C. Evans of the Department of Defense, and Dowdle Davis of the Kansas City Call. And gentlemen, we appreciate your forthright and enlightening views on a question of vital interest to Americans and, in fact, throughout the free world. I think we can readily see, as stated in the final words of the credo of the Negro Press, that truly all are hurt as long as anyone is held back.
Thank you, Ben Grauer, and members of our panel. Now here is William O. Walker, publisher of the Cleveland Call Post and secretary of the National Newspaper Publishers Association. Mr. Walker will announce the 1955 winners of the Russ Worm Awards.
Each year, the National Newspaper Publishers Association recognizes 10 persons, organizations, or institutions that have made a substantial contribution to a more truly democratic America. The awards are determined by a vote of the members of the NNPA from nominees submitted by members of the association. The citation reads, "The Russ Worm Award is proudly presented to the recipient in recognition of outstanding achievement in making possible a richer conception of democratic principles and in tribute for upholding those highest traditions considered as the ideals of the American way of life." The Russ Worm Awards this year go to President Dwight D. Eisenhower for his continued insistence that merit, regardless of race or color, shall determine the fitness of men invited to government service and the steadfast manner in which he moved to make the city of Washington, D.C., a model of real democracy. This marks the second consecutive year in which President Eisenhower has been cited. Dr. John H. Fisher, superintendent of schools in Baltimore, Maryland, for his forthright and immediate implementation of the Supreme Court decision outlawing school segregation in such manner as to ensure complete equity for pupils, teachers, and community tranquility. Willie Mays, for outstanding sportsmanship and skill in his chosen profession as a baseball player for the New York Giants. Ed Sullivan, for his forthright position in behalf of democracy and democratic beliefs. J. Ernest Wilkins, for exhibiting the qualities of leadership and character as well as competence in his field, that earned for him the post of Assistant Secretary of Labor, the World Council of Churches, for its demonstration of democratic principles through the election of Negro clergymen to high executive positions, for its enlightened leadership in religion as expressed through resolutions dealing with race relations. The Regional Council of Negro Leadership in Mississippi, for rallying the people of Mississippi against reactionary efforts to ignore and overthrow the mandate of the Supreme Court eliminating school segregation, and for courage in withstanding economic and personal reprisals brought against their group as a result of their stand. The parents and children of Virginia, South Carolina, Delaware, Kansas, and Washington, D.C., who, as plaintiffs in the court action which resulted in the Supreme Court decision declaring segregation of public schools unconstitutional, made possible what is probably the greatest forward step yet taken in establishing true democracy in our nation. Charles C. Diggs, Jr., representative from the state of Michigan, whose qualities of leadership and community concern earned for him a seat in the House of Representatives, thus serving as an inspiration to youth and advocates of clean government over the nation. The 10th Russ Worm Award this year goes to the Metropolitan Opera Company, which has pursued a policy of increasing liberality toward Negro artists in the past several years, resulting in the recent dropping of color bars as applied to featured performers. We are delighted to have with us in the studio Mr. Rudolph Bain, General Manager and Executive Director of the Metropolitan Opera Company, who will receive the award in person. Mr. Bain, it is indeed a pleasure to be able to present to you and to the Board of Directors of the Metropolitan Opera Company this award.
Thank you, Mr. Walker. In accepting this award for 1955 on behalf of the Metropolitan Opera, I would like you to allow me to add to my gratitude also the expression of a hope. That hope is that a day may come, and come soon, when awards such as the one you are bestowing on the Metropolitan today will be a thing of the past. You understand, of course, what I mean. We at the Metropolitan were very happy to have had with us such fine artists as the great Marian Anderson, a promising young baritone such as Mr. McFerrin, and a lovely dancer such as Miss Collins. And indeed, I'm glad to say now that Miss Anderson and Mr. McFerrin will again be with us next season. However, there should be really no merit attached to engaging fine artists. Indeed, an opera house, like any other artistic institution, ought to engage artists strictly and only on the basis of talent and performance as a matter of course. And this is what I have been trying to do, and this is what I intend to continue doing. Thank you.
You have just heard Rudolph Bing, representing the Metropolitan Opera Company of New York, one of the winners of the 1955 Russworm Awards, presented by the National Newspaper Publishers Association. Now, to conclude this special broadcast observing National Negro Newspaper Week, here is George Schuyler, associate editor of the Pittsburgh Courier.
This week, March 13th to 19th, marks the observance of the 17th annual National Negro Newspaper Week, sponsored by the National Newspaper Publishers Association. Each year has seen the principles fostered by the Negro press accepted by more and more people throughout the world. Each year has witnessed a steady march by the American people toward that place of leadership among modern nations that we alone are best equipped to fill. An uneasy world needs the reassurance that we are to be counted on the side of fairness, justice, and righteousness. The Negro press is determined to lend all possible aid in the accomplishment of these ends, confident in the conviction that the ideals which gave birth to our nation shall be the realities that will make it endure.
The National Broadcasting Company has just presented a special transcribed broadcast commemorating the 128th anniversary of the founding of the Negro Press in America. On this National Negro Newspaper Week program were heard C.C. Desjoie, Jr., president of the National Newspaper Publishers Association, Lester B. Granger, Roy Wilkins, James C. Evans, Dowdle H. Davis, William O. Walker, George Schuyler, Ben Grauer of NBC, and Rudolph Bing, representing the Metropolitan Opera Company of New York, a Russworm Award winner. Harry Frazee directed our program. This is Mel Brandt speaking.
Hear Morgan Beatty and the news of the world over most NBC radio stations.